All right.
Morning, morning. Please be seated.
Morning, Governor.
Okay. The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Timothy M. Wright now presiding before court number 23CV253, Vanguard Trading Company, LLC versus United States. Will all counsel please state their names for the record, starting with plaintiff's counsel.
David Craven, Craven Trade Law, on behalf of Vanguard Trading.
Robert Liu from Balance Law Firm, on behalf of plaintiff Vanguard Trading.
Good morning, Your Honor. Nico Gurian for the government. And with me is Chelsea Reyes from Customs.
Morning. Okay. And our team, Alex, will you start us off?
Alex O'Connor, law clerk to Judge Wright.
Justin Schmidt, law clerk to Judge Wright.
Okay. So, counsel, good morning. You have our questions. There's a bunch of them. So let's try to, I'd like to ask if you can be very focused in your answers to the questions. So we can move right through them and hear what we need to hear and get on with our day. So we'll start with question 1A. Plaintiff, can you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the key question here is that at the time of entry, everything was disclosed and was proper. The only issue was whether or not it was a Type 1 or a Type 3 entry. And for that case, there was a legitimate question as to whether or not it was a Type 1 or a Type 3 entry. And at the time of entry, there was a reasonable belief that that was an accurate description as a Type 1 entry. And to the extent that it is evasion, I think you have to also look at the clerical error exception 2A, where if you're going to allow a clerical error, which means you knew that the goods were subject, but inadvertently that they were not subject. But here you're going to say we didn't know the goods were subject and we entered them as a type one. It creates sort of an unusual situation where a conduct excused by a clerical error is less is more egregious in some ways than the situation we have here. And we would argue that the term clerical error could be read broadly enough here to include a question as to the coverage of the goods. But in any event,
just to go on your clerical error point, what case supports that conclusion?
There is no specific case supporting it. There's not a lot of court precedent for EAPA cases yet. I don't believe that issue has been directly addressed.
Okay, thank you. That's a good, clear answer. My question, I guess, Mr. Craven, is if we go with your reasonable belief theory, when could IEAPA ever be applied?
IEAPA could be applied in many circumstances. Firstly, the belief has to be reasonable. And as you can see, from all the arguments that were presented in here, there is a lot of legitimate question as to whether or not this good is in fact subject to the anti-dumping duty order. And the fact that we've had such a hard fight with the United States over having the Commerce Department, the master of scope, even look at it suggests that they agree that there is a problem, that they don't want Commerce to look at Commerce to look at the classification. And we'll talk about that later in your other questions.
May I interject? I've been around the trade remedy laws for a piece of change, as my children are wont to remind me. I had a lot more hair when I started doing this. It's hard to imagine very many cases where there isn't a fair amount of contention over the scope or whether a good might be subject. I remember the efforts to put into place the anti-circumvention provisions of the 1988 Act. So are you really sure that This is an unusual circumstance where there's a significant dispute about whether a product is subject to an order. And if you go to pipe, it's whether the pipe is 1 centimeter too large or whether the wall is 1 centimeter less thick. Don't many, many, if not most cases, present these kinds of issues?
In my experience, Your Honor, most EAPA cases don't present these type of issues. Mostly in the case of the EAPA cases, it has to do with questions as to where the goods were manufactured, goods, the nature of the manufacturing processes, and so forth. And here, almost no issue is in dispute. And that's one of the points that I think we will talk about later. There are no, literally the only dispute between the parties here is the goods, the physical nature of the good subject to the order or not. There's no dispute as to country of origin. There's no dispute as to manufacturer. These are types of disputes you see in EAPA cases that we don't have here. Literally, the only dispute is the classification, essentially, of the merchandise.
Mr. Craven. Mr. Gurian, do you wish to comment on this? And then I'd like to move on.
Just briefly, Your Honor. Just to answer the question as posed, the determination of evasion based on a misclassification like this falls squarely within EPA's definition of evasion. You need entry of covered merchandise through a material or false statement or document that results in the non-paying or underpaying of AD/CVD duties. So from the perspective of the statute, there's no difference between entry paperwork indicating type 1 versus type 3. Than entry paperwork indicating country of origin X as Y. The question, what's going to determine if there in fact has been evasion, is going to be whether that's false. And so when plaintiff's counsel talks about this legitimate dispute, that really is collapsing into a question of was it false that we entered it in this way, not an argument as a legal matter that an alleged misclassification of this kind can never be and can never constitute evasion.
Let's move on to question two then.
Yes.
And how is the answer you just gave me consistent with the Diamond Tools decision?
So, Your Honor, I think Diamond Tools presented a distinct set of facts than the ones that we have here. And so the key issue in that case was at the time of entry, the way that the importer entered the merchandise was based on really what was express guidance from the government. There was this public 2006 IDM from Commerce that essentially said, do it this way, enter it in this way. And that's what the importer did. Subsequent to that, when there was a change of position and a follow-on EPA investigation, the court essentially held Customs hadn't provided a good explanation of how it can say the way the importer entered this is false when they did it at the direction of Commerce. And in terms of stopping the government from making.
And how is that different from what we're faced with here?
There is no similar public direct guidance to the importer in this case. There was just the language of the scope order, which is going to be true anytime there's a scope order and there's importation and there's a question of covered merchandise. And so that's, I think, why Diamond Tools is distinct from the case we have here.
Thank you. Mr. Craven, any comments on Diamond Tools before we move on?
I would argue that, again, Diamond Tools does, in fact, apply here, that the nature of the goods was clearly provided by Vanguard at the time of entry. The only question was, did we report it as a type 1 or a type 3? And based on the clear language of the scope and our understanding that
in Diamond Tools, though, what I think Mr. Green was alluding to was the IDM. In the IDM, the petitioner in that case came along and said, we don't like your scope decision because we think it's going to lead to circumvention and we think it ought to be this other kind of thing. And Commerce said, thank you very much. It's not that other kind of thing. We don't think it'll lead to circumvention, but if it does, we'll look at it at the appropriate time. What comparable exchange that made very clear what the order did not apply to, as well as what it applied to, exists in this case?
Well, I think you have to look at the whole history of the order and the fact that the scope in this order changed after the preliminary determination before the Commerce Department, and there was a legitimate question as to what constituted silica. And we think that ultimately the scope decision from Commerce was not clear and has continued to be the subject of scope rulings. And our evaluation of our merchandise indicated...
With all due respect, that's my point. The scope ruling in Diamond was crystal clear. And not only was it clear what was in, it was very clear what was not in. And that's what the plaintiffs did there, or the importers. Yes. They saw what was not in, and they did it.
And we believe that...
Well, you believe, but there, the Commerce Department's own words said what was inside the circle and what was outside the circle. And I'm asking you, where here does Commerce say exactly what was on this side of the line and what was exactly on that side of the line expressly?
Expressly, what Commerce said was silica and the percentage of silica. And silica is a very specific compound. And our product was not silica, chief weight silica. Our product was chief weight other materials, which included within the structure silica, but was not themselves silica.
But we have a record here, and I don't want to argue over what's in the – we're going to come to what's going to be in the record. Sure. But you're talking about a point that's not in agreement here in terms of what's in the record, what the percentage of silica was of your product, the imported product. So I don't see maybe one last brief shot. I'm not persuaded that you've brought Diamond Tools into your corner yet.
I understand, Your Honor. I think maybe it will be clarified when we get further into the record as well.
Okay, very good. On question three, I guess, Mr. Craven, I have the same question for you, which is the court asks about a good faith disagreement here. Doesn't this prove too much? Won't there always be what could be characterized as a good faith disagreement? With all due respect to our colleagues at the Department of Commerce, Customs Service, they do hard and difficult work. Not always crystal clear what the scope that they issue. Won't there always be what could be characterized as a good faith disagreement? And in that respect, I come back to my original question, when could you ever actually apply EPA?
Well, I think we go back to the fact that the vast majority of EPA cases don't really have to do with issues vis-a-vis scope. EPA was really intended to address those situations where a company engaged in manufacturing operations outside of the country where the goods were being made and in some way producing goods that evaded the scope. And here, most of the issues that traditionally would be raised in EPA are not present.
Okay, I was trained to look at the statute. I don't really understand what you mean by most of the issues that would traditionally be raised. The statute has fairly simple wording. It includes both the type of classification as well as issues of where the merchandise came from.
Yeah, it's a very broad statute. I will acknowledge that.
No, that wasn't quite what I was saying. But thank you. Okay, part B, Mr. Goya, may we start with you and ask you why the government didn't seek a remand here as it did in Nicodan?
Sure, Your Honor. I think for two interrelated reasons, the first being that Customs felt confident that there was substantial evidence on the record to support a finding of evasion without the scope ruling on the record. And the second really is a question of timing. The scope, final scope determination from Commerce came out at the end of January 2024, which was long after the initial TRLED finding of evasion and then R&R's affirmance. Whereas in Icodin, the scope ruling came out 10 days before the close of the EPA investigation.
Mr. Craven, would you like to comment on that response?
Sure. I think, Your Honor, the reason that we ended up going for the scope ruling was because we were unable to get TRL-led to seek advice from the Commerce Department. And then the timing of the scope ruling and the time and when it was issued is ultimately in the control of the Commerce Department. And so those two things together led us to, we were trying to get a scope ruling to clarify things when Customs wouldn't go to Commerce. Well, we have a lot of statements on the record requesting, again, that they go to the master of the scope to get a determination.
Well, since you've opened that issue, let's skip ahead. Think we're in part 2 A, sections, questions 1 and 2. Isn't it up to Customs to decide whether they wish to refer a matter to Commerce for their input?
Well, I think it has to be within reason, Your Honor. Again, the Customs doesn't set the scope. Customs interprets the scope. And when substantial questions are raised as to scope, it is not up to the Customs Service to make the decision as to scope.
The statute says if Customs is unable to determine. Sounds like
yes.
They're in the driver's seat there as to whether they believe they're not able to determine. No?
Well, I think
the language of the again, it's been a while since I left law school, but I think the training was read the statute. The statute says if Customs is unable to determine. That sounds like under Loper Bright, we're being asked to decide whether Customs made a reasonable decision that it was unable, or in this case, not unable to determine.
Right, and I think you're right. The word there is reasonable, and it is our position that in a situation such as this, where there is a legitimate, substantial dispute as to scope, that Customs cannot reasonably determine that it can make the decision. And I think that comes down to, in part, a reasonableness argument.
Yeah. I'm troubled. I mean, directly, Mr. Craven, I'm troubled that I don't see the limit to your argument. I don't see where, if we accept your position, I don't really see where this stops. Not to say that attorneys do not serve a fantastic purpose in our system, but in my experience, again, of some number of decades now, there is frequently, if not most of the time, disagreement over how a scope is written and whether it should include or should not include. So if we, Customs is required to refer, which is not what the statute provides, if it's required to seek this advice, whenever there's a disagreement over the scope, it seems to me, I don't, how do you tell us, what line can you give the court that would enable us to decide in your favor without opening a hole that's big enough to drive a 747 through?
And that is legitimate. I understand the court's concern. I think the question ultimately comes down to, it's an evaluation of the relative facts and what's determined reasonable, because otherwise what you've done by not including a reasonableness test within the interpretation of the statute is you've basically enabled Customs in an arbitrary fashion to simply refuse to ever seek advice from the Commerce Department. And yet the statute specifically provides that. And I would point out again, in most EAPA cases, The Commerce Department's view on whether or not a good is within scope is not relevant. And so this is a very unique, limited set of circumstances within the EAPA statute.
Okay. Mr. Gurria, can we guide you to part 2A, questions 1 and 2, and then we're going to, I think we missed a question that we'll come back to on part 1.
Sure.
Can you address the question of Customs authority to seek the advice of Commerce?
Yes, Your Honor. As Your Honor noted, the language of the statute is clear. Customs shall refer to Commerce if Customs is unable to determine. That necessarily presupposes a step one determination by Customs as to whether they are able to make that determination. And if they are, they're not required to refer the matter to Commerce. And that's what happened here. And plaintiff's counsel is really, it sounds like, is essentially asking the court to rewrite the statute to add the word reasonable, but that's not in the statute. And that's consistent with what the court found in Eichedin, in finding that Customs has an independent obligation to make the determination about whether it needs to refer to Commerce in the first instance.
Well, in candor, I threw out the word reasonable, and I probably shouldn't have. And Mr. Craven, being a good and effective counsel, pounced on the word. So I hereby withdraw. The word reasonable doesn't exist in the statute. The statute says, as we've been discussing, it's Customs' decision when it considers that it is not able or unable to determine. Mr. Craven, anything else you'd like to say on 2A, 1 and 2?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, let's go to Mr. Gurria. I want to back up just to 1C, which I don't think we had a chance to discuss.
Your Honor, with 1C, the new factual information was the fact of the scope request, and I think I can clear up sort of chronological confusion that the question is getting at. So that May 12th date that's referenced in the scope ruling that we attached, that was actually the date of Vanguard's resubmission of its scope request. Vanguard initially submitted its scope request to Commerce on April 17th. That was rejected by Commerce. So the timeline, April 17th, initial scope request by Vanguard, May 11th, Customs rejects the written arguments in this case because it includes new factual information, i.e. April 17th scope request. And then the day after, on May 12th, Vanguard resubmits its scope request to Commerce, which then leads to the final scope determination from Commerce that the merchandise is within scope.
Okay, Mr. Craven, any comment on that?
Well, yes, we submitted the scope ruling and it was rejected and we resubmitted it. I disagree with Customs' interpretation of the scope ruling, and we will undoubtedly get to that in one of the later questions. I don't think that the scope ruling is being interpreted correctly, but we will discuss that.
Okay.
Alex, are you okay with this?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've done, let's move on to section 2. We've done 2A, both questions 1 and 2. I want to come to 2B, Mr. Craven, to you, if you could point us to the text of the statute or regulations that support this, the assertion that the court reproduced in question 2B.
I probably overstated it when I said the text of the statute and regulations supported that position. However, I would point out that would render scope rulings, the timing of which is ultimately within the control of the Commerce Department, could potentially render them inapplicable in EAPA provisions. And in this case, again, the statute itself says that the case is suspended during the time that Customs is seeking clarification from Commerce. Now, when the regulations, and I'm trying to find in my case brief where it was referenced. When they were drafting the regulations here, one of the points that was made and one of the reasons listed was that the option of getting a scope ruling was discussed in the regulations. Just a second. CBP's own regulatory guidance, and this is discussed at page 9 of our scope ruling, where it says that apart from CBP's authority to refer issues to Commerce for a covered merchandise determination, an interested party also has the ability to seek resolution of a scope issue before Commerce pursuant to Commerce regulations. CBP does not believe that an additional mechanism is needed in this rulemaking. Well, if you can't suspend the case while it's before Commerce, then the ability to seek resolution of a scope issue before Commerce is essentially rendered moot.
But your client could have sought a scope ruling from Commerce at any point.
Yes. We were trying not to overly complicate the record. We believed that Customs would be seeking that ruling, and we didn't want to have multiple administrative proceedings ongoing at one time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In retrospect, I probably would do something differently this time.
Any, Mr. Gurry, anything else you want to say on this point?
No, nothing further on that, Your Honor.
Let's go on to, we're in 2B. I'd like Mr. Craven, I want to start with you, and I actually want to take question 3 first and then go to question 2 here. Isn't the whole question of whether Customs should have sought or when it might have sought Commerce's input or the issue of the scope ruling moot because Commerce ruled in the same way that Customs did?
Commerce didn't rule the same way that Customs did. Commerce ruled that a particular slab was within scope, but it also held at the same time within that scope ruling that, in fact, a non-mineral slab of the type brought in by Vanguard would be not subject to the order if the lab tests were to support that. And we have a different set of lab tests in the EAPA matter than we did before the Commerce Department on the scope ruling. And the scope ruling ultimately supports a proposition that you may import this type of product as long as the lab tests support the presence of non-mineral, non-silica minerals. And the
problem was that in the record, though, the lab tests that were submitted could not be verified to be the same product as the subject merchandise. That's a problem, isn't it?
That is a problem. I would point out that the lab test that we submitted in the EAPA matter, we believe tie much more closely to the goods that were submitted, and there's an absolute absence of any lab tests from Customs of any kind that are relevant to this decision.
Well, the problem was the lab tests could not be verified as being the same merchandise as Customs was considering. That's a problem, isn't it? If the burden was on the respondent to provide information to support the conclusion that there's a different chemical composition of the product, And the tests don't say that that product is the same thing that Customs is looking at, those tests don't appear to be reliable.
We believe those tests were reliable because they were tests of the same series of product. Did we have tests of the identical shipments? No, because by the time this case arose, the goods had all been distributed. But we had lab tests on the same series of slab product.
Thank you, Mr. Craven. Mr. Gurria?
I think we're jumping around a few questions, Your Honor. So is it all right if I sort of jump around with you? Point one as to the mootness question, it is moot. There's nothing left for Commerce to do. Commerce has issued a final scope ruling. Vanguard could have sought review of that scope ruling in this court and did not. And so Commerce's scope ruling is final, and it was on the merchandise at issue here. In terms of the lab report that Vanguard submitted in its supplemental voluntary submission, Your Honor is correct that there's nothing tying the lab report to the product at issue. So if you look at the cover letter and the lab report itself, the only information is given is a sample name, Frytec Dark, and a sample number. We don't know where that number came from. We don't know where the sample came from, whether they got it from a factory, whether they got it from a customer. It's unclear. And another point that I think is important about the lab test, Your Honor, is there's no information that was provided that explains the discrepancy between the finding of the lab report that Vanguard submitted and the chemical composition of the product and the patents that Vanguard itself submitted. And that's an issue. These are patents that Vanguard provided in their CF28 responses that describe the chemical composition. So for example, the lab report Vanguard submitted purports to show that the silicate chain ferriwinchite makes up the majority composition. In neither patent and none of the multiple embodiments of the invention in both patents is ferriwinchite discussed. If you look at the second patent, there's actually testing of the invention done by X-ray spectrometer, which shows in two different versions of testing more than 56% chief weight silica in both. So again, we have all this information on the chemical composition that Vanguard provided the agency and nothing to explain the major discrepancies between that and the lab report.
Mr. Craven, give you the last word on this one.
We believe we did explain that the patent was the initial embodiment of the good, but that the lab test reflected the final formulation. And the purpose behind the patents was to show that, in fact, slabs can be made from more than simply quartz, and that these non-quartz slabs can be produced from a range of product. And as it happens, the embodiment for the patent included more silica. But the ferriwinchite was what was in the actual goods shipped. And that's what the lab test reflected.
Excuse us for a moment.
The product, right? And, but they could not tell him that it was attached to the actual report.
This is for point.
And just to clarify, why did plaintiff not submit the or respond and not submit the same tests that it submitted to CBP for the evasion inquiry, to Commerce for the scope inquiry?
Because we submitted the lab tests to Commerce that tied to the specific product that we were seeking the scope ruling on from the Commerce Department.
Okay. Thank you. So in part three, we discussed the lab reports a bit more. And to clarify, Mr. Craven, is it your position that the customs conclusion that the reports were unreliable, that is an arbitrary or capricious judgment on their part?
Yes, Your Honor. And also the absence of any lab reports, customs, customs attempted to put two other lab reports on record, but those lab reports, as customs I think will now acknowledge, had nothing to do with the issue.
Mr. Gurria?
Yes, Your Honor. So for the reasons I think I just discussed, the finding of unreliability was reasonable. With respect to the two customs lab reports, those were lab reports from tests of slabs by an importer that CBP initially believed was tied to Vanguard, and so that's why they put them on the record. But after further review during the investigation, CBP determined essentially they couldn't draw the initial connection they thought between the tested slabs and Vanguard slabs, and so affirmatively just did not rely on those lab reports in its final determination.
Got it. Okay. I think you just answered question B.
Yes.
Mr. Craven, would you like to come back on question B?
Well, I don't want to, I can't come back on question B at this time because the reference in our case brief is to confidential information, and you've requested that we withhold discussing that until the end.
Is it important to your to what you would wish to present to the court, in which case at the end of our non-confidential conversation, Mr. Hugh can close the meeting and you can make your point on this confidential information if you wish?
I think I can make a general point, which is the country of origin of the one of the lab tests, for example, was not China. There was never a dispute as to whether or not our goods were made in China. And including a lab test there, there just doesn't seem to be any reasonable basis for including that lab test other than to put a secret lab test of record that we were unable to see, which we were trying to figure how to rebut, because we could not see the country of origin of the lab test.
Are we talking about the one that customs ultimately did not rely on?
Yes, the other ones the customs ultimately did not rely on, yes.
But they didn't rely on it, so why is that relevant to us?
Well, it is relevant in that it shows an absence of any lab test that customs has on non-mineral slab. They had the opportunity to test non-mineral slab, and they didn't do so.
Absence of tests, Mr. Gurria?
Sorry, Your Honor?
Absence of tests. Did Customs have sufficient evidence before it to reach its conclusion in the case?
It did, Your Honor. Again, this goes back to the two patents that Vanguard itself submitted in response to the CF-28 requests. Both going into detail as to the chemical composition and both indicating that all embodiments of the invention are more than 50% chief weight silica.
And Mr. Craven, you, what is your issue with the reliance on the two patents that Customs used in the case?
I think, Your Honor, it has to do with the fact that in the decision itself, when Vanguard was attempting to make administrative argument, it appeared that Customs had some sort of evidence that we were trying to address, and distract is probably the wrong word, but it certainly pulled our attention away from focusing not only on our lab test, but also on trying to explain a lab test we could not see.
Okay. Let's move to our final discussion on covered merchandise. Question 4A, Mr. Gurria, may we start with you?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think there are a few good examples as to the RFIs that would have yielded information pertinent to the covered merchandise determination. So, for example, the RFI asked Vanguard to provide a product list of all merchandise products imported from China, a narrative description of the product, and a breakdown of the composition of each product. That's at Appendix 5215. So a breakdown of the composition would have given sort of direct information as to this question of chemical makeup, which is key to the covered merchandise determination. The RFI also asked for product brochures and catalogs that would have indicated how is Vanguard advertising, marketing this product? Are they calling it quartz slab? Are they calling it something else? That could have given an indication as to what the product is. Similarly, asking for purchase orders and contracts that could tell us what are the suppliers providing, what raw materials are being purchased, which again goes directly to the chemical composition. And finally, Your Honor, the RFI asked for a list of employees who determine in the normal course of business whether imports are subject to AD/CVD duties and the information that those employees relied on. So again, that information, what Vanguard's own employees are relying on with respect to scope determination would have yielded information for customs.
Mr. Craven, your client didn't answer any of these questions. Couldn't it have assisted its position had it provided some information to customs?
We did answer a portion of those questions, Your Honor. We certainly provided brochures about our clients, about our product mix. And with respect to the others, those were somewhat of a moving target.
I don't understand. What do you mean by moving target?
The nature of the products changed. It was not a consistent set of products. Again, this is an evolving area in terms of the nature of the product, but we certainly provided brochures discussing Frytech and why Frytech was not a quartz slab.
Okay. So I think you've answered the last question, question B, that it is your position that the patents were unrelated to the merchandise subject to CBP's investigation here. Is that right?
I think our answer is that the patents were unrelated to the extent that the patents themselves, the goods were modified from what was described in the patent, that ultimately the patents provided the general guidance. But as with any kind of new technology, the goods themselves were continuing to move along the spectrum. And there's nothing to prevent a patent holder from modifying their formulations while still...
Go ahead.
While still protecting the patent. The point behind the patent was that these particular goods are safer. And the nature of the non... Of eliminating the free silica, and when they determined that in fact it needed to have more mineral content in it, it had more mineral content put in it.
No, I understand this. It strikes me though that a business that's engaging in import and export trade and understands that there's a certain amount of information out there that's going to be used to assess what the product is. And if they're changing the product, they better top up their information so that what they're actually bringing in, based on how you've put it, is going to be considered for what it actually is, as opposed to as you posit, and as your client posits, that it's something different. So,
Your Honor.
Sorry, go ahead, Mr. Craven.
Except, Your Honor, that when you have the patent, the nature of what you have done is disclosed completely to the public. When you modify the patent and you don't reveal that, that becomes a trade secret, which competitors would be unable to replicate. So the patent provides the basic protection, whereas the trade secret provides the magic formula at the end.
I've had some familiarity with working with trade secrets, but if you're going to be importing something, we do have confidential business information opportunities, and those are restricted. And that's what I guess I was suggesting. I have one last, so before, for, well, I have one last question to CBP, and it concerns the terminology that's used in IEPA questionnaires. Once the initial findings have been made, Customs identifies the product as covered merchandise, when in fact that's still to be determined. And wouldn't it be more parallel to the way Commerce conducts its anti-dumping and countervailing duty investigations to call it subject merchandise, even after a prelim? I don't think Commerce calls it dumped or merchandise subject to countervailing duty, because it's confusing to me to call it covered merchandise, especially because that's the whole issue that Customs is investigating.
I see your point, Your Honor. I think that it calling it covered merchandise after the TRLED determination of evasion makes sense, because from the perspective, from Customs's perspective, the substantial evidence on the record has established that it's covered merchandise, because they felt able to apply the scope to the merchandise. They did that, and the application was such that the entered merchandise was covered. So I think that's sort of the reason why they're calling it covered merchandise there.
But the parallel again would be if after a prelim, Commerce called it dumped merchandise. But it's not, because they have to go through their files. Similarly, CBP has to go through the completion of an IEPA investigation.
That's true, Your Honor. That's a fair point. I mean, I guess it's covered subject to R&R's de novo review of the finding of evasion. I guess if R&R, if there's a finding of evasion and R&R reviews it and makes a different decision, then it no longer, you know, its covered status sort of evaporates.
May I suggest that you and Ms. Reyes take back to CBP the strong suggestion that it's confusing, and that what they ought to do in their IEPA questionnaires is call it something other than that. Could be merchandise subject to the review or the investigation, but it seems to me to be misleading.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Thank you. I saw Ms. Reyes passed you a note. Was there something further that?
No, I think we've covered it.
Okay, Mr. Craven, any closing comments on the discussion this morning?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for taking the time to hold this hearing.
We appreciate your participation, and Mr. Gurria's and Ms. Reyes's, and we'll wish you all a good afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise. Honorable Court now stands adjourned.